So we have on Sally Carbon. It's been ages because I know that it's been, I think, a year now since I've seen you and I was talking to you about coming on the podcast. Now, you're a gold medalist, an Olympian gold medalist and World Cup gold medalist. You're an author of 9 books. You're a mother of 3 and a company director. Now, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. And I know it's been a year, but wow, what a year, obviously. I know, yeah. So it's fair enough. You've got a lot of excuses, Wayne.
No, but I was excited to get you on because writing is one of my favourite pastimes. And it's been very therapeutic for me in a lot of ways, even as a kid, to be able to escape into a world for me that only I know, that only I can delve into. And I love talking to other writers because I'm sure they feel the same way. And I've got like a ton of questions. But I'm sure that a lot of mothers out there just heard mother of 3, an athlete, an author. How the hell does that happen? Now, like, how do you balance all of that with time?
Yeah, well, one thing is I finished being an athlete before I became a mum. So,
okay. I was gonna, yeah.
So they're like completely separate. And yeah. It's quite funny now. I'm actually 53 right now. And I played state league hockey until I was 40. So, you know, you throw in your few Olympics, your World Cups, your other big international tournaments. We won so many state competitions against the other states, so national competitions. We won everything. And now at 53, I can see that person as though it's a different person. So it's as though I'm watching the news or seeing a still picture and I don't feel I can relate to that person, that absolute unbelievable athleticism. So I'm just a mum like every other mum now.
But surely some, you know, the discipline it takes to be an athlete follows through in a lot of areas in your life?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I'm still the mongrel that I was back then, so the spirit and everything, but the physicality I can't find. In fact, I'm extremely jealous that I don't have it anymore. I'd love to, you know, when I'm sort of driving along the freeway and I see someone running in parallel, I'm desperately, you know, sad that that's not me anymore.
Could it be?
Well, I've had 7 knee operations and just recently had my hip replaced, so the body's a little bit ruined. But the answer to that question is always yes, and that's just me probably being a bit lazy.
And when you were a kid, Sally, what did you want to be? Do you remember what you wanted to be when you were a kid?
From a professional, you know, sort of working life, I absolutely as a kid would have drawn a blank. There was no doubt about it. I wanted to go to the Olympics. In fact, walking home from school every day, I would put the school bag down at the same tree on an oval just before the house and I would run 200 metres and I'd do it spelling the word Australia. And I actually visualised the Australian tracksuit. And you know how Australia's always in an arc across the back?
Yeah.
I was spelling Australia with every 200 metre run I'd do. And that's very intense for a 10, 11-year-old to do now looking back, but that is what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to the Olympics, and I was a good track and field athlete. I was a ballet dancer in my youth, and like serious ballet dancer. I could do all sports, like, you know, I swam very well and all the rest of it. So I didn't really care what sport I was going to play. I just wanted to go to the Olympics, and that was it.
Has that been in your family at all? Like, did you have athletes as, you know, parents and grandparents? Or,
well, the whole family is very sporty. You know, my dad, he was originally did medicine at UWA, and to get through medicine he was a professional runner and a professional swimmer, so that was an income source, you know, back, you know, way back sort of 50 years ago. And my mum still holds a state record in hurdles, so she was a very good hurdler. There's a little asterisk to that, is that she had the record when we had the imperial measurement, so yards, and so no one can beat that record ever. But she was coached by the great Shirley Delahunty, you know, so yes.
It's been in the family.
It's been in the family, yeah. Because but no one ever really dreamed of the highest level. No one sort of gave themselves permission. They were good athletes, but they didn't give themselves permission to really take on the world.
Do you think that's nature or nurture? Because as a 10-year-old, who does that? Who does that as 11-year-old, 200 metres and then starts spelling out Australia? Yeah. And it's you've got to be born with it, I think.
I'd have to say that's innate. I was just like that. I was just really determined to do whatever I wanted to do, and I'm still like it today, very much still like it today. And my parents definitely weren't pushy parents. They sort of just exposed us to everything. I was also very arty, so I'd be taken to sort of pottery classes and everything. So it wasn't a, you know, get out there and train sort of mentality. It was just a, you know, here's the world, go and grab it if you want to. And I chose that athletic pathway.
Now, as an athlete to a writer, you've got, you know, this excessive exercise and discipline. Same sort of discipline, but now you're trapped behind a computer. What age, do you remember what age you were when you thought, you know, this writing thing could be a thing? Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, in high school, you know, just doing English and all the rest of it, if we had to hand in an assignment, you know, 2-page prose of some description, I would write a series of short stories. So I'd write 10 of them and submit it for one assignment, or I'd write a book of poems and submit it. And that was not because I wanted to get good grades, but because it sort of bled out of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and to be perfectly honest, I really didn't care so much about school. It wasn't the most important thing because, bang, I was going to the Olympics, right? So I did school for being a sponge. I wanted to learn as opposed to get good marks. I sort of did pretty well anyway from a school perspective, but it was more about the fact that I just wanted to, you know, do whatever I wanted to do.
Wow.
And so it happened early, Wayne. That sort of writing desire happened early.
Something that I always ask is, do you remember completing your first book? How old were you when you completed your first book?
Well, no, I've got 53 years to divide up here. So the first one, my first kid's book, so the official book that came out, you know, in that commercial sense, publisher, all the rest of it, was in 2003.
2003.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Because I can't imagine what that would feel like. You always see it in the movies.
Yeah.
The box gets delivered to your door.
Oh, and you open it, flick through it, smell it, all that sort of stuff. But remember, this is, you know, sort of 2003, sort of back before that sort of self-publishing and, you know, the box being delivered sort of thing. Couple of really poignant moments to me was when the publisher puts a contract in front of you. You're signing away, and being a good company director, I, you know, read the fine print, for instance, and it said the words, this contract is for the term of your natural life. Now, that's a big statement for the term of your natural life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you're going into this partnership for the term of your natural life, and I think that was really poignant. You know, that was the first book moment for me. But then when you publish children's books, there's obviously that great interaction with kids, you know, when you're sort of going on tour and all the rest of it. And I can remember being an Olympian, we also were asked often to go and stand out in the front of classrooms, for instance. And, you know, you wave your gold medal and you dress them up in their Olympic clothes and, you know, hold the Olympic torches and everything. And they love it. It's all, you know, take photos and everything. However, the standing up with a book is next level, which is really interesting, you know, being a gold medalist when you're used to people sort of going, wow, you know, blah, blah. Standing up there as an author, and the kids go, and you sort of hold the book up and you say, see, that's my name across the bottom. I wrote this book. And the kids go, the eyes are big, and they go, Miss, is that you? Did you write that book? And they really, you could just see the penny drop. And to me, it sort of was really quite poignant where kids, even in this day and age of, you know, or the digital world that they live in, the book and school kids are synonymous there. They go hand in hand and they just really treasured the fact that you wrote this book. And I would say the reaction was even stronger than you're a gold medal out the front, Miss, you know, that sort of positioning. And that was also a really poignant moment to me. So they rated that higher than an Olympic gold medal, or they had greater connection to it.
Oh, interesting.
Mm.
And yeah, and that was around 2003,
yeah,
you said?
Yeah.
When did Harry Potter come out? I wonder. It's been like, it was over like 8 years or something. But that got kids back to reading again.
And that connection back, you know, that it was okay to read and it's okay to sit in the corner and be immersed in a story.
I remember being on a train and seeing like a tiny kid with a school bag, and the book was huge, but they were engrossed in reading. Yeah. And, you know, even if you don't like the stories of Harry Potter, you can't help but give credit where credit's due, that it brought kids back to reading, you know, got them away from the electronics a bit, got them back to reading. And I think that's sort of benefited a lot of writers that are coming into the industry after that, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know? No, it's okay to read. And it's sort of pre that time, we were sort of almost hiding. We were almost hiding our books. It was sort of nerdy, wasn't it, to read? Whereas now it's okay.
Oh, yeah. Have you always been a reader?
No.
Oh, really?
Well, it's very hard to read when you're running and sweating. And the other thing that's really hard, as an athlete, you're always tired. So I'd try and read, but you know what it's like when you're trying to read and you go and then you reread the page and then you go. So when I read, I churn. I'll do an all-nighter, but then I don't do it consistently.
Do you listen to audiobooks as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, love it. Yeah.
I got hooked on it. I've been on audible.com now, I think, for 6 years. Yeah. And it's just become a habit. Like whenever I'm in the car, when I'm walking, it just means that I'm still getting through stories. Yep. But now at least you can have your headphones on and do it whenever.
Yeah, and you can feel the pace of somebody else's sort of interpretation by their voice.
You can get some good readers and really bad readers.
Yeah.
Would you read yourself? Would you do your own audiobook?
Well, I have been asked to do my two adults novels in, various forms of, should I do it? Should a different voice do it? And that's what's really quirky about my books is that it's actually written from a male's perspective. Oh, so should a female voice be reading it, for instance? So I'm sort of at that stage.
True. Yeah. Because I have to admit, when I started reading the book, I got about, I think, 10, 11 pages in and I thought, hang on, because my mind, I think I knew who you were. I knew that you were an athlete. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that point of view, but then suddenly I was like, oh, hang on, no, this is a male. This is a point of view of a male here. And then it was fine. But I don't know, I think people see your name, athlete, they expect that. But I think it's interesting that you write from a male point of view. Yeah. Can you tell me what brought you to that decision?
To write from a male point of view? It wasn't a decision, it just happened. In fact, it wasn't a decision to write these books. They were in me and they just came out of me and they were trapped in me for years and years and it was basically a 10-year journey from concept through to release, and that's, a lot of people find that quite interesting. It was a 10-year journey, and when you think about it, I played hockey for Australia for 9 years. This book was longer than me playing hockey for Australia. So it was a massive journey. And when you go through a journey of that long, you change your thinking, you change your personality, you change as a person so that your writing changes, et cetera, et cetera. So, and your confidence goes up and it goes down, which has a big impact on a writer. So, this came out of me. It wasn't conscious, this writing from a male's perspective. I just felt for them. So the reason why I wrote these books is because I feel for high-performance athletes.
Yeah.
I bleed for them. Even the hockey roos at the moment, struggling with mental health, and there's a lot of big issues that are going on with, Collingwood Football Club. A few years back it was the swimmers. I bleed for high-performance athletes. I know what it's like on that side. So this story was me backing them up. I wanted to go out and back these athletes up. And in this particular case, the person with the voice was a male, and I didn't think twice about the fact that I couldn't write from a male's point of view.
Good on you. Mm. Good on you for that. Mm. And that could make your book stand out even more when you do talk about it. Have you been on many shows or interviews where you've spoken about your books?
Yeah, most of them they don't. The interviews don't allow you to get in deep as to the reasons why. It's more about what the product is.
Right.
So you don't often get to deconstruct and come right down to the depth of why you wrote as a writer and what you're trying to say and, what sort of readers should read as well, because in this world of choice, for instance, you can write a very, very commercial book that has a wide audience, for instance. That's the first thing you've got to do as a writer. And then you've got to go, do I want to expose this material to everybody, or do you want to just go into a niche market? And my choice was I just wanted to go into a niche market. I just wanted to express this to people who want to understand about high-performance athletes.
Yeah.
In a complete fantasy storyline that goes with it.
Where did that naughty side come from?
Oh, I knew you'd go straight there. Well, athletes are naughty. They're dead set naughty.
Yeah.
You don't become a very good athlete if you don't have that naughtiness to you. If you're not the personality who not only wants to push the boundaries but absolutely jump over and get to the cliff on the other side, you're not going to be a good athlete.
Yeah.
So we're talking the same language. And it's the same with, you know, rock stars or even CEOs of big companies. You have to at times play dirty, you know, everything. You have to push and push and push and challenge the norms. And, you know, this is the case with these athletes as
well.
Also
because you would think as well they're under so much pressure. And like I was reading your brief and, you know, these high-end athletes, there's just no leeway in their life. So maybe that naughtiness can be a coping mechanism too. You know, like you hear police arriving on scenes and ambulance drivers, they have the weirdest sense of humour.
Mm.
And it can be very crude at the wrong times, but it's a coping mechanism. I don't know if that's, you know, athletes are under this pump all the time that this naughtiness is just a release valve.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of truth in that because going to the Olympics, for instance, it's a four-year journey to go to the Olympics. Mm. The first 2 years is training as though the Olympics is not going to happen. You know, you're just in this world of train. And then with 2 years ago, they start to become real. And then 1 year to go, you're under so much pressure for selection to get into the team. And then, well, just before that, you're actually under pressure to get Australia to qualify for the Olympics, for instance, or the country that you represent to qualify. And then you've got to get yourself into that team. And then you've got to go and then, oh, wow, you're just on the start line for performing. You've got to win. You know, you're going there ranked number one in the world. And if you don't come number one in the world, you fail, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just this pressure build up for 4 years. And what you get taught in the process of going to the Olympics is that the moment that that story finishes on the last day of your competition, you'll go absolutely dead set mad. You'll go crazy. You won't even know who you are. And this is what happens with your psyche, for instance. So there is this moment of absolute release of pressure, and beware, that's when you're all going to get in trouble. And that's when they come down the heavies.
You can understand that.
It's basically padded walls.
You can understand that.
Oh, yeah.
Because you think after 4 years, you know, and then, I mean, if Australia is known for one thing in the Olympics, especially with women, it's hockey.
Mm.
Really?
Mm.
I mean, what else? I mean, there are
swimmers
other,
are pretty
they're swimming.
Good.
Swimmers are pretty good.
maybe Kathy Freeman.
As a team,
yeah.
As a team sport,
yeah.
I don't think you can go past the women's hockey, even the men's hockey, you know.
Yeah.
So you were there for how many years?
I went to two Olympics and two World Cups, but the women's hockey team through that reign is considered the best sporting team in the world. Now, that's a very big statement. So
that's
how successful it was, not just at the Olympics but at the big tournaments all the way through at the same time.
It must have been nice to be part of that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Well, you know, that journey sort of went on for, you know, 20 years. So we're sort of all slide between that. But, yes, we were definitely part of it. And our West Australian team also made history, the most national wins anywhere in the world as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did read that in your briefing.
Mm.
I didn't quite understand it because it was just so in the world.
Well, you look at some of the big basketball teams and whatnot that have had success over a long period of time.
Mm.
These teams are better than them from a, you know, pure results.
What do you miss most about that life as a whole?
I know I'm supposed to say my teammates. I know I'm supposed to say, you know, the learnings to cope with the pressure cooker and all that stuff, which are both of those two things are fantastic. But I'd have to say I miss the extremely low skin folds.
That's the truth, right?
It is dead set the truth because it's intoxicating being that fit, you know. And people who are really fit know that it's a drug. And it's, you know, like even just sitting here now, I can feel a little roll in my stomach. And I hate it. I can't stand
really?
It. Yeah, because I'm used to being able to tighten my abs so hard.
But you've had three kids. Three children.
I'm being honest.
Even just
walking up steps, you know that you've got two lines on your quads that contract, for instance. You know your calf muscle and then your soleus underneath. You know, just everything about your body is so insanely fit that's what I miss.
That would be torture.
Yeah.
Because you're only getting older and, you know, you're never going to get back to that. You could get back to a level of fitness, but obviously not Olympic level.
No.
So you're just torturing yourself.
I'm just being truthful.
Now, getting back to ideas, I know that's been your world in sport and you write from that. I often have creative artists that come on here, painters. I've had a world champion athlete in my last podcast. When it comes to creativity, where do you think that comes from? Do you think it comes from a collective consciousness or it comes from something within you and your experiences here as a person?
Well, it definitely comes between experience, that beautiful word of wisdom, for instance. You know, we're all in this world today, we're starting to balance out the need to be intellectual versus the better position of wisdom. And wisdom is that intellect plus life experiences, whereas, you know, probably up until 10 years ago, we only rated people who were intelligent as the most important ones. So I'm a real big believer in wisdom and that balance between, you know, being academic but sort of learned, I suppose, which could just be reading or whatever the case is, but plus life experience with it. And that's why there's just a lot of the big companies, you know, like the big resource companies, for instance, are actually creating their own learning environments, sort of perhaps sort of walking away a little bit from the typical universities and having their young workers come through their own pathway, for instance. And that's because they're trying to get that really good balance between a learned person and also one with fantastic life experiences. Yeah. And not perfect life experiences, ones that, you know,
are flawed.
It's just a really good new age way of thinking. So
you learn from the flaws more than you do
absolutely.
The
exercises. Absolutely. Yeah. You learn from pushing yourself, failing, you know, being wrong, getting in trouble, you know, that's the way you learn. And that become, you know, if you learn to work with it, that's when you become filled with wisdom. So, you know, that's one answer to you. But also I had a beautiful moment when I first released my first book. I was sent on tour by the government up the very north of Western Australia in the Aboriginal Indigenous communities. And this was pretty well straight after coming back from Olympics. So, you know, I still had my six pack on my stomach at that time, Wayne. And I'm still, you know, sit-ups, push-ups, you know, eat this amount of food and all that sort of stuff.
I know where you're getting at because I was going to ask you a question about this. Keep going. It's about the Indigenous lady.
Manya Andrews. And she, we had this beautiful moment where we were with kids just basically sitting in the sand and Manya told her story and then I told my story. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm so wrong. I am so wrong in this environment. These kids are teaching me a lot more and I had to really reconsider this world of discipline and all the rest of it, because when you're so disciplined, you sort of lose your creativity. Yeah. You lose your life experience and, you know, you're sort of all but doing that equivalent of just intellect. You lose it. You're blocking it out. So at that particular night when we sort of came back to our rooms, Manya said that to me, Sally, creativity is like a muscle. Now, you've spent your whole life building your muscles, so you'll understand this. We're all born with a certain amount of creativity, but if you don't use that muscle, it goes.
True.
And you've got to work on it, even if that muscle's small right now. Build it. Keep building it. Keep building your creativity muscle like you've built your, you know, your abs and your quads and all the rest of it. And I have never forgotten it. In fact, of all the fantastic people I've learned from in my life, that's right at the top of the list for me.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, even right now I'm just covered in goosebumps thinking about that moment because, wowee, our life these days is so disciplined and so wrong or right or judged or whatever the case is that just – wake up every day and keep building our creativity muscle because we were born with it. Yes, and it was, I'm just about in tears, Wayne. It's so important to me.
It is. No, I understand that because when I taught for so many years and I would see these people, this past students, they've become friends now. Mm. And what you realise is that if you don't exercise that muscle, people that are creative – that's food for the soul for them. Mm. if they don't feed that soul, it's so easy then to slip into things like depression, anxiety. And I've noticed that with creative people that aren't exercising that muscle, and it could be something simple like take a photograph, write a one-liner, something. If you don't do that for, say, a few weeks, a few months, you start to get affected in other ways. You start to start thinking negatively. You start to get a bit anxious about things. And I realized that about myself. Wayne, I need to tell stories in one way or another, if it's writing, if it's podcasting, like we're talking about stories now, taking a photo. If I don't do that, I start to slip. I start to slip. And, you know, suddenly a bit of insecurity starts to come in. And really it's because I'm just not exercising that muscle. So I totally understand that lady that said that to you. I was really curious when I read that. I was like, oh, what is it? What is that, you know, that happened up there?
Do you know, in the human body, we know that, you know, from the Olympic pathway, that we do, you know, gym work pretty well every day on top of our normal training, for instance. And we, we're told as of, our body drops off 70% of our strength within 2 weeks.
What?
70%. And that's a female body. Men, a male body doesn't drop off at that rate. But female body, we drop off 70% of our strength within 2 weeks. Imagine if we had a measure like that for our drop off in creativity over time. Because what you're saying
that's
is
scary.
It is scary. And, you know, this is why sport is so scientific. But the creative world, we need to know more about it. And we, you know, as a community, we've got to fish deep and dig deep and find out a lot more about what creativity does for us as individuals and as a community.
It's as important as the other subjects at school. You know, I remember listening to a TED Talks and one guy was talking about education and that we need to get back, like, to nurturing creativity in kids. Because that with, like you said, wisdom with the practical knowledge is when magic happens in that way. And I think we need to get back to that because a lot of our education now is based off the industrial, you know, the industrial revolution. We're not in that revolution anymore. We're in the information age. Yeah. And I think kids need to be nurtured in certain things. It's not just mathematics, English. And it should be, it's that, also things like creativity, drawing, things, you know, that get you out, dance. Things like that that can get you through.
And then that beautiful saying that there's no time limit to creativity, that's really problematic in our world where it's all about time limits.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so we're not enabling that free thinking space. You know, in the corporate world that I work in, for instance, bang, 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 you know, you're on Zoom calls at, you know, 10 o'clock, they finish at 10:59, start your next one at 11 o'clock. The corporate world has just absolutely lost its creativity as well, and you need it to perform.
Is that what you're trying to do, is inject some of that back into the corporate world, or is it very hard to do that and change cycle, you know, change minds?
I challenge the corporate world to think this way.
Tell us about your schedule in writing. What would your day-to-day be in writing?
When I was writing heavily for books one and two of my Australian team series, I had a schedule which I just blew up. And that's because when I'm on a roll, I can't stop. So I would, I tend to perform better in the morning. So I would start sort of 5 o'clock in the morning and I'd say to myself, right, stop at 10 o'clock and then move on to something else because I sort of have different working roles at the same time. And I couldn't stop at 10 and I'd keep going and there'd be times that I'd still be going at midnight and I did all-nighters as well. So my scheduling was hopeless and that's because I did it too much. I couldn't stop.
It's hard to.
It's very hard to stop. And my problems weren't about not starting. My problems were stopping at times.
Which is not a bad problem, but it is when you've got other things you've got to do. I think that was the problem with me is I lost balance in life. You know, I forgot I was married and that, you know, I was starting to prefer that world.
Oh, absolutely.
To the world I was living in. And it was very hard to come out. And the problem also for me is I work better at nights.
Yeah.
So my writing schedule was 11 p.m. To 7 a.m. But you can only do that for so long because I just thought I need to get myself back into my life again. So then I went and I started to do cafes. You know, my laptop's got 3-hour battery life. Yeah. Let's go to a cafe, write for 3 hours, come home and do other things. But it was very hard to get a balance, to get a balance in that. So I always ask other writers, is it your schedule? Do you stick to it or do you, because I understand what you said, to be able to just write and don't stop until, you know, you start to get tired in that sort of way.
Yeah, and I had to use some of the sporting tools that I got, because you know how you said that you preferred that other world than, you know, the world you live in, for instance. It's so true, because it's in your head all the time. You're writing characters that you actually expect to walk in the front door and sit down and have a beer with you. They're so real to you that they, this blurred line between what your day-to-day life is and this story that you're telling, you know, they become one.
Yeah.
Your characters are real. They're so real to you because they're in your head all the time. So it is very hard. So I actually had to start using what we would do in sport, and that is if our sports psychologist would teach us when we got to hockey training that there's always a white line around the outside of a pitch, and we always would use that white line to step over.
It's a psychological anchor, a visual anchor.
We had to use the white line, and we were not – if he ever busted us walking over that white line, talking to somebody else or just doing it without any consciousness whatsoever, we would get told off so heavily it's not funny. We actually had to stop at the white line, look at it, and make that decision, right, we're stepping into the world of being a world-class athlete right now. And then when we walk back of it, we actually had to stop, look at it, step over it, right, I can become Sally again.
Sure.
And it's the same with being a writer, for instance. You have to have some visual clue to say, right, you're switching on. But in our case, we're switching off as well.
The visual anchor that we used to use in acting, because actors that would be trained in Strasbourg, which is a form of method acting, mm-hmm. it was an unzipping exercise.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you walk off set, you sort of physically unzip and step out of a character. And it was just a physical anchor that they could do that would help them leave that behind. Otherwise they would take it home and it would be, you know. And I think we all have those sort of anchors that help us, you know, in that sort of way. How long, Sally, does it normally take you in your team series? Mm. How long roughly, I know you do a lot of other things, but what's the time frame of finishing a book, and were they different?
I reckon if I put a time limit on myself, I reckon I could write one of these novels in 3 months, but I'd have to basically eliminate everything else in my life to do it. And they're thick novels, right?
They are.
Yeah, they're thick novels. So, you know, sort of probably slightly equivalent to a Harry Potter size book, for instance. And so I reckon I could go into the zone, write heavy for 3 months and then step out of it, and that's when you go into editing mode with an external editor. So I reckon if I was in the perfect world, I'd do that. But our worlds aren't perfect, so I think I would have to say a year. It'd be a year to write a book of this size.
And what – like I see you sitting across from me, athletic or athlete, creative, corporate world just doesn't fit for me. Like, tell me why. Like, why, I mean, what led you into that world? Why are you staying in that world and what keeps you there?
Work, if you can answer it, tell me, please, because I have always been a diverse person. So I did maths at university. Like, work that one out, and sort of being an author at the same time. So I, a sporting person, same side of the brain, is typically mathematic, music, sport, for instance, and the creative side's the complete opposite side of the brain. So I've obviously got one of those brains that's not necessarily one side or the other.
That's great.
Well, maybe it is great, but it means that you know, who am I?
That's exactly my wife.
Yeah.
She sits there every afternoon. Mm. Because she's got a business mentor at the moment and working out what her self-worth is. Mm. And it pisses me off because everything she does it very well. Mm. She was a producer in the movie industry and she got to the high. She worked for Warner Brothers and did really big things. At 35, she then decided to quit the film industry, become a lawyer and go through law school. Yeah. Now, that's what you were just saying, mathematics, athletic, writing. She's, so she's two sides. But then it's, who am I? Yeah. And she's constantly asking herself that. And I keep saying that it's not important. As long as you're doing what makes you smile, why do you have to be labelled this or this or this? I don't know. Is that a struggle that you've always had? Or?
Well, one thing I've worked out is that there's no right person out there,
no,
is there?
No.
So you are who you are, you maximise who you are, and you're right, you swing right to left depending on, you know, some outside forces at the time or the rest of it. Now, you ask why am I in the corporate world? Because I'm very good at it.
Yeah,
it's the me in the middle of this right and left. My big passion in life is to be good at things, and that's very embarrassing to say out loud, but that's what drives me. I love learning and getting to the top of my game.
Not for someone else to
judge me, but because of me, that's who I am.
That's the discipline that came from athletics too.
Or was it there before I got to athletics, and that's why I got good at sport? You know,
true. Have you always been asking yourself those questions?
Well, I can remember thinking back to high school. So I'd go to high school. I actually had 4 jobs in high school, you know, the cafe, the news agency, you know, all those sort of things, whilst I was building up to being a world-class athlete. Now, everybody just equals one, don't we? We're all just one. So how do you – you're taking 10% out here, 10%, you know, 50% and all that sort of stuff, but we still add up to one.
Sure.
So I just maximise my one. That's all it is. I'm not 2 or anything like that. I just do the most I can in who I am.
What you've got.
And I, you know, the moment I wake up in the morning, it's not a little sleepy. It's a ding, right, let's maximise this day. And it's every day of my life. I'm just sort of upbeat like that.
Yeah. I came to that in the last few years that I realised how important time is.
Mm.
You know, in many things, in from 2017, I suddenly that became the priority.
Mm.
How I choose to spend my time is the most important thing. Like, I'm never getting back this morning, ever again.
Oh, sorry.
No, I mean this morning. But how I choose to spend my time here now talking to you is what I want to do.
Mm.
So it's sort of surpassed every other ambition like money and things like that. How I choose to spend my time is the most important thing for me.
Yeah.
So I do understand that. I do understand that in that way. And I always wanted to ask as well, something, what did writing reveal about yourself that wasn't there before, do you think?
It's very revealing. What that is, it's probably a different answer, but it's writing, so the kids' book's probably less revealing. You go into less depth, and writing a kids' book is fits in that perfect world, which is why I wrote these adult novels as well, because you can't go and you can't challenge kids as much as you can challenge adults. You sort of have to write a little bit to a formula, for instance.
Sure.
You know, it's sort of going to go in the school library and things like that. So, you know, you're a little bit, you know, you're in your tram lines when you're doing kids' books. You sort of got to teach them morals and values and, you know, throw in a bit of behaviour and a bit of Australian culture and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's a bit of a formula that you need to follow. In the adult world, well, throw it out. The most weird thing about adults' books is that they're not rated like films are. You know, there's no rules. You can throw whatever. You can slit people's throats.
It's great, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. You know, you can do anything to another person, to the reader. You can do anything to them.
So the restraints are off, Sally
Absolutely
Carbon.
Absolutely off. And that's what's been really weird for me. So I have, you know, you said you've exposed, you know, what has it exposed to me? That I'm really loose. I'm really wild. That's what's exposed to me. And that's in complete contradiction to this corporate world, which is just so orderly. And there's so many rules in the corporate world. Whereas this other life, there's no rules.
Isn't that good?
Scary though.
Yeah.
It's much easier to live your life in rules, isn't it?
It is. But I've just never been that type of person. Mm. You know, I mean, you've got to remember I was in academia for 12 years. But, you know, put a backpack on me and give me something with no rules. And I love that. I love that.
Do you think most people would love that? They don't realise.
Do you know, I often used to say that, yes, they just don't realise it. If they knew, they would do that. But I've spoken to some people that just are not that way.
Mm.
They're just not that way at all. Like, I've got best friends I've grown up with my whole life. And yet I often try and analyze, we grew up the same. We had similar experiences when we're younger. Two totally different outlooks on life. Mm. And I don't know where that comes from. And when I talk to them about, like, their job,
mm-hmm.
they don't like their job. They've reached high levels in their work.
Yep.
You know, I'm talking, you know, in their companies, like, I won't mention their company because they'll know, but, you know, they've reached high levels, don't particularly like their job. Some of them suffer anxiety.
Yeah.
But yet they don't know. They, you know, one time I asked my two friends that were splitting up, unfortunately, a couple, I said, you know, what is it that you want to do? And they both looked at each other, and I couldn't get over this, is they turned around and said, Wayne, no one's ever asked us that before. Yeah. And I thought, but don't you ask yourself?
Exactly.
Don't
right.
you sit there and ask yourself, or you're in the shower and you're thinking, what's my purpose? And and I thought everybody asks themselves that, but, you know, no.
Yeah, we get stuck in this routine that we have to be in that position. So, you know, you ask me, you know, how do I fit into the corporate world? Well, I do, and then I step over the line and fit into this creative world as well.
Sure. Mm. And
I give myself permission. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you still have that anchor, that sort of mental anchor of when you step away.
Yeah.
And you go into the corporate world and then into the writing world where there's no inhibitions and things like that.
Yeah.
Next question is following. It's a good leeway into the next question. How has your family accepted you as a writer? And did they understand, especially with the adult books, did they understand that is part of who Sally is, or was it a surprise for them?
You know what? I have never actually asked them, you know, are they okay with this or whatever the case is, because that's not how I've lived my life. I've always sort of given myself permission for it. They were very supportive. So I've got three grown-up kids. You know, one of them, for instance, is really in that film and television world, and he, you know, really encouraged it. In fact, he's have to be the most encouraging one. Another one, for instance, she was a young athlete at the time, and, you know, so she got the athlete side of it, for instance. And my husband's very supportive of it because, you know, it's in the sporting world that he sort of grew up in as well. My dad's always wanted to write and release a book himself, so he did the first draft of the edit just to sort of, you know, pick up some things in there as well. So everyone's very, very supportive. But one of the things I've worked out by standing up in front of audiences and talking about books, for instance, I do a straw poll every time. Who here has always wanted to write a book? And it's at least 80%.
Yeah.
So everybody wants to do it, which means they're supportive of you doing it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. The subject matter is probably a different discussion, but they've all got a book in them and they've all wanted to release a book.
Right. It was the subject matter for me. Like, I used to write a lot of thrillers and it's because of what I grew up in.
Mm.
There's other sides to me that I know if I started to venture into that, a lot of friends and my wife go, oh, you know. Yeah. So I just, you know, how family accepts you as a writer is a big thing too, you know. So, but you've not really asked them, or they've just gone along with the flow and accepted
that they've probably known me, you know, all my life for pushing the envelope a little bit in everything I do.
It's a good example for them though.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they don't have to be me. They don't have to push the envelope. They have permission to be them, whatever they want to do.
What do you do other than corporate world, being a mother? Do you have any other escape besides writing, watching sport, being a mother in corporate world?
Yeah, I don't do much other stuff. So I run a business, and my business, I'm a corporate strategist, so I go into the very big global businesses and deconstruct the direction that they're going on and help them go in a different direction.
Oh, okay.
And that's very formulaic, so it's very mathematical. And it's needs a lot of emotional strength with it as well, because you're working with the big CEOs and the general managers. You're basically picking up their business and pivoting them and going on a different direction. And that usually takes about 9 months. So there's you have to stick to it. And yeah, you do have to be very disciplined to assist them. And then you have to help them to tell the stories to everybody else to go on the journey with them as well. And there's a lot of research. It's heavy. It's really drill down, really heavy stuff. So that's my corporate job. I'm also a company director, so I'm a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. I've been on boards for 28 years now, and that's also very structured. Being a company director is very formulaic. And, you know, I've got three kids, as you said before, and I write as my complete opposite side of me. And I just, you know, socialise with my friends and my family, and that is it. So I'm not a big traveller of the world, if we could.
So the writer is, the writing is the escape, basically, definitely. From that sort of side. What do you think makes a good story?
First response to that is that there's no rules. So who knows? And if there was an answer to it, we'd just be plugging out those stories. True. And, you know, there's huge diversity in stories that are out there. The good story is being able to get the reader to feel something in either the character or the plot.
I think so.
Yeah, so it's got to hit their heart somehow.
Do you write from the seat of your pants, or are you a plotter?
Mathematical and strategy. I'm a plotter. I've had times where I've got a big long whiteboard and I plot to the side of it the pace that I want that one. When an external event happens, you know, I've got columns. I'm doing a strategy.
Yeah. Mm. Do you know, I used to write that way. My first few screenplays. Mm. Screenplays are a little different because you actually have a time frame. Mm-hmm. So everything works within, you know, a feature length show of 90 minutes to 120. Mm. So everything is quite structured in that sort of way. And so I used to write with scene cards, and, you know, my process is that for months on end, I would get these index cards, and anytime I had an idea, I would throw it in a shoebox. Mm. And then at the end of 3 months, I'd lay them out on this table, would you believe? And I'd lay them all out. And then I'd spend another month. I'd come home every day and I'd move the cards around until I can't move them anymore.
Yeah.
And then I'd get writing. And, you know, it was okay because I directed a lot as well. And yet I started to lose the love of directing in a way, because I used to direct what I wrote. Mm-hmm. The writing for me was the creative side. The directing, it was literally, now I've got to recreate what I'd already seen. It's like watching a movie again and again.
I'm with you.
And it just became very stale for me. Mm. I loved working with actors, and that was one thing that I loved doing. And then I read Stephen King's book on writing. I don't know if you've read that.
I've read a lot of his books, though.
This is actually him talking about writing. Mm. And I was in Thailand, I was getting my teeth done and I couldn't eat anything. Mm. And I was in bed and my mouth was swollen and I was reading this book. And he was talking about a story can be like a fossil.
Yeah.
Like you brush it, but you don't know what the fossil belongs to. And every day you don't know how you're going to get out of certain predicaments. And I thought, God, that sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Because suddenly it puts me in the reader's position. But yet I'm the writer, and, you know, I don't know what made me do it, but I had this commission job. It was to write this thriller based in Hong Kong and Australia. I'd never been to Hong Kong before, so I had to do all this research about Hong Kong and learn the streets and the smells. And I thought, I'm going to write this like how Stephen King writes his latest books. He used to plot, and then he said, you know, in the story Misery, Paul Sheldon would have never have worked out how to get out of the room picking locks if he hadn't written that book. Mm. But it all came to him as he was, you know, just thinking, waking up that day and going, how am I going to get out of this room? Hang on, I wrote a book on car thieves. Surely they know how to pick locks. Mm. And he goes, if I'd plotted that story, I wouldn't have come up with that idea. So anyway, how this screenplay industry worked is every 3 months I would have to deliver. But I'd have to write in 2 months the draft, then I'd send it to America, my editors over there. The editor would have to do all their notes, and sometimes they'd come back with 70 pages of notes. I'd have to collate their notes, my notes on the next draft, and then give it over to ScreenWest, and then I'd get paid.
Mm.
And then off again. And I decided that I was just going to write by the seat of my pants. I know, talk about, it was the best writing experience I've had. It was the most stressful because I needed deadlines. Yeah. I needed to work to deadlines. Yeah. Otherwise I wouldn't get paid. Yeah. But every night I went to bed, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning because I kept thinking.
Because you were dusting away Stephen King's Fossil, weren't you?
Fossil, yeah, in my own story.
So if you were enthused to write, your readers would be enthused to read because they'd be picking up your fantastic anticipation.
And I was writing, you know, my protagonists have been female.
Yeah.
So that's why I was, you know, I understood where you were coming from. Mm. And because I think the strongest people in my life have been women around me. And so I couldn't wait to get up because I'm thinking, how the hell is she going to get out of this predicament? And it was more of an investigative piece. Mm. So I was investigating the clues as I was finding them, not knowing at that same time. But it was one of those experiences I didn't want to go to bed because I didn't want to stop the journey. And I couldn't wait to get up in the morning because I can't wait to start this journey again. And when I finished, it was like I had lived this character through this story. And so I ask writers that sometimes, and I've never written a novel. I don't know what that's like. I'm looking forward to expressing thoughts because you can't do that in screenplays. If it's not on the stage, it's not on the page. Yep. So if someone's feeling anxious, when you're looking at them, how do you know they're anxious? Mm. You've got to write those sort of things. But I can't wait to be able to write about what people are thinking.
And it's brilliant. That's you know, it's inspiring listening to you do that because it's exactly what my life's like as a writer. There's somehow that structure, has to kick in because otherwise you just keep going, expressing the anxiety of that person and you never get anywhere. So you've got to balance the difference between, you know, that anticipation of that character and
where you're going.
Because you've got to have kickers at certain times.
Do you get much feedback from your writers?
Yeah, well, interestingly, when you write a book like I have written, which is not necessarily for the mass market, you get quite polarising feedback. And for a new writer to release a product, it's the most horrifying thing, waiting for your feedback to come back in, you know, your reviews in this particular world. It's horrible. It's absolutely dead set horrible getting reviews from, you know, various people. And then over time you get quite used to it, and not that you get, you never get used to feedback, to be perfectly honest, but you actually start to segment where it goes in your brain. You can cope with it because you get polarising feedback. Some of it saying, nah, it's not for us, basically, with a whole pile of expletives with it. And then you get some from others saying, this is the best thing that I've ever read. I've really appreciated it. I love the characters. Please write some more, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the day, you think, well, this is just an analogy of life.
It is.
It's just, you know, you can walk into a cafe and you can feel people, oh, God, what is she wearing? And then you can walk in the cafe and this person over here goes, you know, like, I'm feeling you. I'm feeling you. And that's what life's like, isn't it? Especially in this world of choice. You know, we can be who we want to be. We can write what we want to write. For instance, if you're making decisions to make money from your books, you need to write for the mass market. If you're writing because it's just coming out of you and you want to do it, you write for the segment that you want to write for.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
I mean, you want harshness and critics, try going online. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, I've never really been one foot in front of the camera. So a lot of my friends couldn't believe I was doing this. Mm. I just don't care, really. Mm. Because really what I found is it's not about Sally and it's not about Wayne. It's the conversation we're having. That's why people listen all around the world. It's really weird dynamic how podcasting works. Mm. Getting messages from Belgium, people I don't know that have listened to two people they don't know. But it's not about that. It was the conversation we're having. You would be surprised who listens to this conversation.
And it's beautiful,
isn't it? It is beautiful.
Even if that person didn't like what you said on that particular day or didn't appreciate a particular guest that you had at that time, they're still listening.
They're
still evaluating, you know, thinking in their lives and how it relates to them and all the rest of it. And that's what you've got to be prepared to do in the creative world. You've got to let yourself out and let people judge you.
It is. I'm just curious about what makes people tick.
Mm.
And that for me was when I saw you, when Ash told me about you, I was just like, okay, here's a mother who's a writer, and then I learned more about you, about being in the World Cup and being an Olympian. It's not so much about your achievements as it is about what your journey is and what's made you come this far.
Definitely.
And I think people that are listening to this that are in another industry also can learn from the discipline of what you're talking about. And it's amazing on how many people it actually helps, these conversations help.
Yeah.
I had on someone else called Eddie Stowers. He does something similar to what you do in the corporate world. He calls himself a corporate anthropologist.
Yeah. I'm not as creative in the corporate world.
And he goes around the world and sort of straightens out companies. I think he goes more from the what was your purpose on starting this company and that sort of way. It was interesting listening to him talking about that because he's an artist too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's an actor and he acts in quite a few television shows, but his job has always been straightening out companies, going in, looking at each department, and it's over like nine months,
wow.
9 to 12 months.
Same sort of journey.
Yeah, same sort of journey, you know, but he's been doing that for years and years and years. And yet he sat here going, I really just want to do acting full time.
Yeah.
if it could pay him that. But it's just not that world where you're getting constant income.
And when you're used to getting the constant income, and I do get a good income from it, it's hard to walk away from.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to take the big risk and walk away from it just for my own self.
It is.
You know, when you've got a family.
Yeah.
It moderates you a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, I remember reading your part of your brief and you said, you know, I like looking at artists that are not, they're not encumbered.
Yeah.
They don't care about, you know, self-critique. If only you could do that full time. Is that the dream, or will you always have that corporate mathematics side to you that you love and the author? Or would you give it all up to be a full-time author if you were making a lot of money in as a writer?
I think that raw, honest truth to that is no, I wouldn't give it all up. And that's not because I wouldn't let go, because we know that sometimes you've got to let go from good to get to great. I'm not that sort of person. But what's most important to me is diversity. If I'm diverse, if I'm interesting, if I think of all people from right to left, you know, all people, and act the same way myself, I have better respect for other people, and that's so important to me. I want to have respect for other people, so I try and be diverse myself.
See, my wife needs to listen to that.
Yeah.
Because I think what you said there is the answer to what she's been looking at, because I don't think that saying, you know, don't be a master of, what is it, you know
jack of all trades, master of nothing.
I think you need to be a jack of all trades now. I don't know, it's just that world we live in where I think my wife would listen to that and go, oh, okay, I need to be diverse.
I want to. It's not a need for me. I actually want to be diverse, because I feel as though it's almost like I can take my blinkers off and say, oh, isn't it beautiful seeing so many different beautiful people? And that's important to me.
That was my flaw when I was growing up, because all I wanted to do was direct as a kid. Actually, I wanted to be Stephen King before Steven Spielberg. And that's the honest truth. I wanted to be a writer first. But where directing got to me was that I got so tunnel visioned in what I wanted that I had blinders on to other things that would give me that love. You know, and I just missed out on a lot of things, I reckon, in my youth, in my 20s, because I moved to Sydney when I was 22 with my current wife. She was my
girlfriend. What's around the corner?
She was my girlfriend and then she became my wife. But we were so ambitious and tunnel visioned in one area. I think what happened is we missed out on a lot of other things that would give us that pleasure, that love. And it was only till we let go, and I think letting go is a really important thing.
It gives you more room, doesn't it?
It does, it does. And I don't know, you just attract things faster. This one Buddhist monk said to me, he said, and I told students this, and some of them are like, oh, Wayne. And it was like money. that you can still own money and still have ownership of money, but you don't need to grab onto it so tightly. If you grab onto it so tightly, no money can come in or leave. You can still have ownership with that the coin with your hand open. So the more, you know, people can take it, more money will come in. It's about letting go and not putting so much importance in that it will come more easier. And I remember this guy saying that to me. And when I tried that, it was true. I started to get more money the less I focused on it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And creative, don't hang on to something. Just let it flow. Let it come through. If I'm not in the mood to write, then, you know, you get your blocks when you write. Mm. A big lesson I learned was, say, like if you've got pets and you think, oh, I forgot to feed the dog, forgot to put out the meat to cook dinner for the kids, is to write that down.
Yep.
So it was a screenwriting exercise. Write down those thoughts because what you're doing is you're letting the creative images flow. You're not stopping them by those thoughts. You're actually writing those thoughts down. I've got to do this. You're building that creative muscle. I've got to take the bin. So you're writing your story and then you get blocked. Mm. But instead of just not writing anything, write what those thoughts are. And then you'll get back to the story. You can always go and delete that section. That was a big lesson I learned as a writer, is not to stop and think, God, I can't think of what's going to happen.
You don't have to be this person all the time. No. Let it out and you'll be a better this person anyway.
I think so.
Yeah.
And what I was getting at is I think what people need to do more of these days is listen. Mm. People aren't listening anymore. You know, they're already coming back with a rebuke or with an argument of they're not listening to learn. And I'm finding podcasting is great for that because it's long form. Mm. You know, I'm not sitting here discussing a counter argument because we've got 3 minutes. You know, I'm here to sort of understand how Sally ticks, what makes her tick, you know, what her influences in her life, those moments like the Indigenous lady that told you the importance of, you know, of creativity and who you are as a person. That to me is somebody else might take that and learn that and go, that's wisdom, you know.
Absolute wisdom.
But I don't think people listen.
But that thought that, you know, we all talk about we've got to listen more and everything. But listening is different to just being, isn't it?
It is.
Because you just said that we're all building up this counter argument. That's exactly what's going on in this world. And this is, you know, we're reading a book to review it or we're watching a film to pass judgment on it. Just watch it. Just read. Just be. Look at some art. Just look at the ocean. Whatever the case is, just be and stop that counter argument.
Be in the moment. Mm. That was a big lesson I learned with the passing of my sister. Mm. Is she turned around and every time she'd ask me to open the blinds in the morning in the hospital and she'd smile or she would hold my hand at certain times. And I said, her name was Fern. I said, Ferno, why are you smiling? And she goes, because Wayne, I don't know whether I'm going to see that sunrise tomorrow. You know, if this is the last conversation between you and me, I'm holding your hand because this is the most important conversation we'll ever have. It made me think how important it is to be in the moment.
In the moment.
And just be and not think about what's going to happen afterwards, what's going to happen, you know, it's or what you didn't do and what you've got to do. That was my biggest lesson. And she taught me a lot in life because she was 10 years older. Mm. So Fern would have been 60 next year. Mm. But those lessons was not about ambition. It wasn't about career. It wasn't creative. It was the important things that she spoke about. Yeah. So for me, these, like if I knew that I was never going to see Sally Carbon again, this would be the most important conversation for me. But there's always a chance we could bump into each other.
Yeah.
But it's nice to think that if I never see you again, if God forbid something happened to either of us, this would be the most important conversation I'm having right now.
Yeah.
You know? And those are the lessons. And that's what I always think when someone comes to sit here, they've got something to share. And there's a reason why Sally's here now. I don't know what it is, but when I'm editing and there's already a few things that, you know, these seeds that have come through and I can learn from that lesson.
Can learn from all people, can't we? We can learn from little kids, people from other countries. We can learn from, you know, what's happening in different countries. There's so many beautiful things. If we can just sort of sit back and go, you know, good lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially as a writer.
And that's wisdom, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is. And observation.
Mm.
As a writer, I used to teach the kids that, especially if we're directing, your observation skills are number one. You've got to pay attention to things, you know, that are happening in front of you. Mm. So with, if you could go back to Sally as the teenager.
Yeah.
You know, what would you say to them? Things that you know now?
That it's okay. I think that's the most important thing, that it's actually okay. And it's okay if you get in the Olympic team. It's actually okay if you don't. It's okay if you don't get into university, because you just sort of got to get up the next day and continue on your journey and sort of interact with people, you know, learn from all things in your life. But it's okay, and be kind to yourself. That's probably the most important thing.
Isn't that true? Mm. I think that's a big lesson for kids now. Do you tell your kids that?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're a mum, they don't listen to you anyway, so I can say anything to them. Yeah, no, they're pretty good.
What's good about this is that when they are our age, they can look at this conversation too. Mm. And I think that's really cool. It's things like that's going online. When you and I, hopefully, we get to, you know, 80 and 85, your grandchildren could listen to this podcast and learn something from that.
I'll have to tell you a funny story about that, that coming off the plane, coming back from the Olympics, you know, we're basically been partying for 4 days, so we're completely unreal. We're, you know, off with the pixies and all the rest of it. And we're walking down the steps of the plane, because they're chartered planes typically to come back from the Olympics. You know, flash, you know, picture the crown, right? You know, flashing bulbs and all that sort of stuff. You're coming down and people are congratulating you. There's, you know, the, you know, lights, and there's people giving you a bunch of flowers and all the rest of it. And the first journalist came up to myself and a couple of others, and they said, "Do you know how important this gold medal is?" Well, you know, it was pretty cool. We quite enjoyed it and all the rest of it. When you die, the only things that will be left are your teeth and this gold medal.
Oh, my God.
And that was it.
Really?
Right back down to, you know, to ground zero.
That's
what the journalist said. So it was funny. I will never forget it. It was a funny moment.
Your teeth and the gold medal
will be. Oh,
thank you.
So I'm sort of picturing myself in this, you know, coffin underground, and there's my teeth and my gold medal there.
You should get the teeth moulded, the gold moulded as teeth.
Yeah, it's all wonderful.
So, Sally, what books do you have with you? Here. Tell me about these two. This is what we've been speaking about.
Yeah, well, these are books 8 and 9 of mine. And so I've got, if you picture 6 children's books there, plus a collection of adult stories, which someone else edited. So there's my 7 books beforehand. This is the first in the series called the Australian Team Series. This one here, Teammates, and this is the second one, Team Pursuit. It's actually a story about 4 male sports players they call themselves a team within a greater team, and it's the journey of the 4 of them together and how they relate to each other. They relate to the coaches, the media, how they cope with the pressure and all the rest of it. So they're thick as thieves, the 4 males. The first 2 books focuses on 1 of the males, but the interplay between the other 3 males is very important to them as well. Book 3, which I'm currently writing, and book 4, jumps onto a focus on 1 of the other males and then 1 of the other males as well. So that's sort of the story. There's the 4 books in front of you. So those 2 but got to come out of me. And it's very, very real about the story of sports people and what they go through. And as I said right at the very start of our conversation, it's actually about, you know, the trials and tribulations of what you actually go – you basically, as a sports person, you hop on a plane – a rocket, and you go to Mars, and until such time that your sport's finished, you come back from Mars, and it's very hard to come back. It's actually quite easy to go there. So it's sort of like, you know, taking you and how you cope with that journey over time.
Right.
And it's real. My God, it hurts even thinking about it. But in this particular case, because they have to be so insular and keep them their realness away from everybody else, because, you know, they'll get picked on, for instance. They will they have this quite an insular life between the 4 of them, and that's where the naughtiness comes into play, because they've got to – the only way they can have naughty any naughty sure. times is by covering it up and keeping it inside. And when you cover yourself up, that's when you get exposed to stepping over the line and being too naughty, because yeah. there's no leveler in life, is there? There's yeah. no extrinsic leveler that keeps you on the ground. So they get too naughty by nature of trying to protect themselves. Yeah,
I understand that.
Yeah, I
can understand that. Yeah. You know what I liked when I was reading the book? What was interesting is you were describing places I knew,
yeah.
like geographic, and that's rare for, you know, because I'm always reading other books from other yeah. authors. And it was nice to see and feel a story where suddenly you're talking about a location. I'm like, I know that location.
Mm. It was really important to me, the location, because I'm such a passionate Australian, but even more so a passionate West Australian.
Yeah.
So I almost wanted to take the readers on a tourism journey of Western Australia.
Oh, you felt that?
Yeah, that was really important to me. One of the funny things is a particular scene in the lighthouse in the surf life-saving tower at City Beach. And so I wrote this because I grew up in City Beach. The you know, I can just picture the surf life-saving tower there all the time. They've taken it down.
Oh, have they?
Yeah. After like 50 years of knowing it's there, it's gone.
Oh, my God. That's like taking down the flower, the dingo flower sign.
It's gone. I don't know if it's going to be rebuilt or whatever the case, but it's gone. So there's a story in here, but it's gone.
You've captured it.
Yeah, it's been captured.
You've captured it. Mm. So you've got two more coming out.
Yeah.
Hopefully next year and the year after.
Yeah, that's the theory. Knowing that it probably takes me a year to bring them out. I had a lot of trouble being creative during our COVID year. I would have had this book out by now. But I felt it's almost as though we sort of had to stop and hold our breath.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be creative during this year, and I'd sort of had to do some research on it. And apparently we haven't been recipients of creativeness as well. Because we're sort of a heightened anxiety, we're not taking in art.
I agree.
As much as making art.
And that was me.
Yes.
And that was a few artists that I knew.
Yeah. So I've had trouble bringing out book three in this year, so it's going to be next year.
I think everybody's waiting for next year.
Yeah.
A new start. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
That psychology of, you know, 2020.
Yeah.
And I think people are just looking forward to leaving this year behind. Yeah. But I knew a few creative artists that suffered through COVID when, at the beginning of lockdown, everyone's like, all the creative guys are like, oh, it's going to give me time to write that book, paint that painting, do that.
No.
It didn't happen.
No, because it's almost like we couldn't breathe.
Because also you don't know what's going to happen.
No.
You don't know what's going to happen. It's. Oh, I mean, come on, it's a pandemic that shut down the world. Yeah. Like, how often does that happen? And then you start thinking, is it going to be hitting here?
Mm.
You know, how are we going to cope with that? Oh, my God.
And you sort of almost like you didn't want to be disrespectful for everybody else around the world as well.
Yeah. On how hard they were going through
it. That's it. Yeah.
So where can people find you, Sally, if they want to contact you or they want to see what you're up to?
Yeah. Well, I do have a website. So sallycarbon.com.au is my website. And, of course, you can get electronic books everywhere around the world. And through my website you can buy these paperbacks, which are signed by me, which I distribute all around the world as well. And locally I get asked to come and do events, and I love events because I get to interact with people.
The book I ordered a while ago, would that have been through your website?
No, you would have ordered through Amazon or wherever you purchase them from. And they that's that print-on-demand system where they sort of they print them and bang them out to you, and I don't even get to see what they look like because depending on which printing method they're using at the time, they come out looking a little bit different.
Sure. Actually, this is a question I've got to ask. You've got a publishing agent now? You've got a publisher?
I had publishing agents for all my kids' books.
Right.
And I investigated it this time. But because I'm a bit of a commercial beast, I sort of know how to do it myself, and I wanted to do it myself.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
And it's more profitable too.
Much more profitable. So from a, you know, just as the pure numbers, because this is what I do in the corporate world, as an author, a kid's book, for instance, if it sells for $24 in the local bookstore, you get $1 from it. You get $1 out of the $24. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Whereas these books, you sort of get about $2.30 per book.
Yeah. After printing and everything.
Yeah. And they – that can be happening when you're asleep and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
for instance.
Sure.
And you can control it by the more effort you put into it, the sales increase and all the rest of it. So I sort of wanted to run this from a pure I wanted the data. I wanted to see the data and the effect, yeah. That's because that's what I do in the corporate space.
That's something I'm going to have to buy you coffee over later once I'm finished with the book and sort of go, okay, you know, I'd like to self-publish. I'm using Scrivener at the moment to write and you know that package? So my mum doesn't. So I'm just introducing her to Scrivener now just so we can – it's a lot easier to edit later on and push it out there. That's great. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's just been lovely chatting.
Nice to have a chat.
You know, hello to everybody around the world and – you know, all the best to everybody.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm sure they're going to enjoy this. And I know a lot of my writer friends, and it's funny because they come from screenwriting, they're going to be listening to this because they keep asking me. I've had so many questions on – I had another lady that was coming on that was an author, but she got too – I think she actually got too nervous because she knew it was being filmed. And she was a – I think she was an older lady. But I keep getting my writer friends asking, when's the – other lady, when's the other woman coming? And, and that was you. And I said, yes, it's coming through, but it was through COVID and everything was locked down. And so I'm sure they're all going to be listening to this now.
Oh, honestly, I could write a list of 100 tricks of the trade that you need to know to self-publish. It's there's a lot of tricks to the game, that's for sure.
Are you going to do that? Are you going to write something down?
Remember, I'm only one.
And a mother. Well, maybe would you come back and talk about more that side of things?
How you self-publish, for sure.
And what – oh, God, that would be a great podcast. So now I've got you on air as proof to say you're coming back, all right?
I will be back.
Thanks, Sally, for coming on.
Lovely.
It's been a pleasure.
Good on you.